cool deal. My wife is with me again, so you know, she's here. And today we also, I do the same thing. We also have our dog, Cooper. But he's not here. He's sitting out in the car. Thing is, if he comes in here, he's such a distraction. I mean, he'll sit here and not move. But you won't hear a thing I say. Because you'll just be going, oh, what a cute dog. And I don't want that. So there's this prayer. Prayer that has been a part of the church from its very beginning, from its ancient days. A prayer that goes back as far as people have called upon God. A prayer that has been uttered more than any other prayer ever. A prayer that is very poignant for this morning. It's a prayer that actually has gone by a couple of different names. It's gone by the name of the Jesus Prayer or the Mercy Prayer. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Okay, this is breaking news. Very simple prayer. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Simple. Jesus, the anointed one, the coming Messiah. Son of David, the rightful heir to the throne, the King of heaven and earth. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Compassion expressed in acts of kindness that address the suffering in my life, the brokenness in my life. Jesus, have compassion on me and ease the weight of this life. I want you to say that with me because I want this to be kind of emblazoned in your thoughts from this morning on. Remember, it's going to go, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. You ready? Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Once again, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Yes, you all get an A. Why bring this up this morning? Because I believe that this prayer actually takes us to the very starting place, the starting point of becoming merciful people. This prayer, in some form or another, goes all the way back to Genesis and moves all the way through the Scriptures. It has very shortened versions where it's simply, God, have mercy on me, or Lord, have mercy on me. And it moves all the way to the New Testament where it starts to take on the form that you and I just said. It shows up over and over again in the New Testament. It's everywhere. You have, for example, a blind man sitting by the river just outside of Jericho. Someone who has never seen anything in his life. He lives in darkness. He's had to somehow adjust life to somehow deal with that loss of sight. He's someone who is just like us. You may not be one who is physically blind, but all of us enter into this world spiritually blind. And even to this very day have places where we're still blind. We don't see things. And as he hears Jesus coming down the road outside of Jericho, as he hears him coming, he calls out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And as he gets closer, the crowd starts to try and get around him and say, stop it, don't say this anymore. Stop what you're doing. But it doesn't work because it gets even louder. Ready? Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. There's another account of some men who have leprosy, a group of them. And leprosy was a disease at the time of Jesus that was rampant. It was everywhere. It had the effect of disconnecting loved ones and separating them so that they could not be with each other. It had the effect of numbing them to the very sensations of the world. They couldn't touch or feel anything. It disfigured them to where they become mere caricatures of what life should look like, what they should look like. And we're just like them. Because that's exactly what sin does to us. It separates us. It makes us numb to the world around us. It distorts us. And as they see Jesus coming, they cry out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." There's a woman that follows Jesus and his disciples as they travel out to kind of the farther reaches of things, out to where Tyre and Sidon is. And Jesus has taken his disciples there basically as a way of getting away and kind of their own retreat. But this woman has chased them. And she's a woman who, for herself, she is physically fine, but her daughter is racked with pain and tormented by demons. Her world around her swirls with pain. It's a mess. She comes as a mother grieving for her child. But she doesn't come asking for mercy for the child. She comes asking for herself. And she chases them and cries out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And it gets louder and louder. She stands outside the house where the disciples are, and she continues to cry out and cry out. And we can go through other examples of this. But you know the interesting thing? That as you go through the scriptures, you find that this prayer is never overlooked by God. It's never neglected by Jesus. Every time this prayer comes up, Jesus responds to it. In some way, he responds to it. I'm not saying it's some kind of magic. Do not pick that up. But it's something that somehow appeals to the heart of God in such a way that he responds to it. I believe it's the starting point for becoming merciful people. There's one more place I'd like to have us look where this prayer comes up. It's in Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18, beginning in verse 10. Because Jesus, you know, he's troubled by the lack of mercy being shown by those who are the ones who should have it most. Those who are the religious leaders, those who are immersed in the scriptures, those who should have their redemption play out this way. But he doesn't see it there, and so he tells a story. It begins, you know, with a simple line. "Did two men go up to the temple?" It almost sounds like the beginning of a joke, you know? It's kind of like, "Hey, two guys go up to the temple, and, you know, the one's a Pharisee, and the other's a tax gatherer, yeah, and guess what happens?" Okay, it almost sounds that way. I imagine a lot of Jesus' stories kind of sounded a bit like that. He sits down with them, and, you know, I can see him just kind of, you know, in the midst of people and say, "Hey, two guys go up to the temple. One's a Pharisee, the other a tax gatherer." Now, by doing that, what he's done is he's shown the two polar extremes of society. The Pharisee, literally meaning the separated ones, those who live a life where they have kind of ordered their life in such a way where everything, as far as they could tell, as far as they could manage, was ordered around exactly what God had said. We're doing everything by the letter, by exactly what God has said. And then on the other end, you've got the tax gatherers. And these weren't simply IRS guys. These were people who had basically become treasonous. They had gone into an alliance with the Romans, the occupiers, and were ones who were siphoning the very life out of society as they pulled in the funds for the Roman government and for themselves. Most of them were wealthy people. But they were despised. And so you've got these two extremes there. And it says that they both go up to the temple to pray, which was common. The temple was not just simply for, it was not just for the sacrifices and the temple procedures, but anyone could go to the temple. And it was to be, as Jesus says, a house of prayer. And so they would go there and be at this place where you'd feel perhaps most close to God. This place that had all the spiritual procedures playing out, and you would come into this thing and you would bring your request before God, or you would speak to God in some way. It says that these two men end up going there. And as they go in, they apparently go in at the same time. But that's where their closeness ends. One proceeds on deep into the temple. The other one stands at the outer edges of it. The first one that's called attention to here is the Pharisee. And it says in verse 11, the Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself. God, I thank you that I am not like other people. Swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax gatherer. Can you picture this guy? Here he is, standing and praying. Okay, now, this is kind of the Jewish thing. Okay, it wasn't like he was doing something unusual. He'd come in and he stands and prays there. But it's interesting terminology. Did you pick it up in this thing? It says that as he prays, he said he stood there and prayed thus to himself. Isn't that kind of interesting? Doesn't that kind of catch you a little bit? You begin to wonder, who's he really talking to here? I mean, is he speaking to God, or is he really kind of more speaking to himself? Or maybe it's simply he's praying this and isn't saying it out loud. I mean, there's all sorts of ways, but it's just an interesting way that this is put out there. But this one prays. And as he prays, he says, God, I thank you that I'm not like everybody else. Now, I'm sure that if I took a poll this morning, in fact, if I went through and asked every single person, nobody's going to say they pray that way. Am I right? Everybody should go like this. Okay, I don't do that. Okay. But we kind of do. You know? We find that thing. Everybody, we all have that thinking. Unless you're dramatically different from me, we have that thinking. Where we look at others and we kind of do this kind of thing, you know? And we see others, you know, sometimes the greatest comfort in life is to see somebody who's more messed up than us. You know, so at least we say, well, at least I'm not on the bottom, you know? Or that we want to distance ourselves from those who make us feel uncomfortable. Or those who somehow bother us by how they live or even who they are. God, I thank you. I'm not like them. And then he names off some. You know, he says, for example, you know, I thank you that I'm not like the swindlers or the unjust or the adulterers. He kind of names off kind of at the time what are the top ranking ones there. You know, I don't do that, and I don't do that, and I don't do that. And I can see him as he's close enough to where this tax gatherer is. He probably kind of looks around and says, I'm glad I'm not like him. That's not for me, but somebody else. As you look at this man's prayer here, there's some things to notice in this thing. One is that he's the hero of his own story, not God. He says, you know, that not only am I thankful that I'm not like them, but I do these other things. I fast twice a week. I mean, that was kind of the formula for the time. Tuesday and Thursday, the exact days they did it on. Which, interestingly, by the way, those were also market days so that everybody could come into town and see them doing it. And Jesus nails them on this thing. So I fast twice a week, and I give tithes of everything I make. Kind of. They had a way, they discovered all the loopholes. You know, they kind of went through the whole thing and found out how they could give a tithe of everything and still have it be to where they weren't given much of anything. And they kind of worked the system out on it. But as you look at this whole thing, he is the hero of his own story. I have done this and this, and I'm not like them. He doesn't thank God that he is like this. He doesn't thank God for whatever he has in life. It's about himself here. The other thing you notice in this thing is really, when you come down to it, he's praying for justice, not mercy. In other words, I have done these things. There should be an equal sign afterwards and good things after it. I'm wanting justice. If I do the right thing, God, you owe me for what I have done. Notice also that he didn't believe he even needed mercy. Somehow, he thought he was in a position where he was good. He was okay. He didn't need anything. In fact, didn't even need God. there's this famous statement that a guy by the name of G.K. Chesterton made. Now, if you're not familiar with that name, he was an English guy back in the early 1900s. In England, he wrote a lot of books. He was a theologian, a philosopher, all this kind of stuff. And a guy with quick wit. I mean, if you read any of his works or if you read his own biography on things, I mean, this guy, this guy was really sharp. And the account is of this one time, he talks about it, this one time where in one of the local papers, they wanted to get some involvement with everyone. And so they posed the question and invited everyone to speak into it. What's wrong with our world? Now, if that appeared today, we could probably all have a whole lot of great comments about that. I mean, you know, every generation probably ends up saying, man, things have really gone down since the last one. You know, and that's just kind of an ongoing thing. We could say all sorts of things. You know, we could pocket people and we could point out things. What's wrong with the world? Chesterton's famous comment is two-word response to that question. What's wrong with this world? I am. Isn't that something? Dead on. What's wrong with this world? I am. I'm a fallen, broken person. The Pharisees, for the most part, there were a few that that didn't fall in this category, but as a group, they fell into this realm of separating themselves and doing procedurally what was the right thing to do and thinking that somehow that made them right with God, but they separated themselves from everybody else. I am not like them. And in fact, had disgust for everyone that was not one of them. There's an account. It's actually in Mark chapter 9, early parts of it, where it talks about Jesus gathering with all the people that the Pharisees just described here. I mean, those were people Jesus hung out with. If you wanted to go find Jesus, most often where you'd find him is with the broken, messed up people. And he would spend time with... Man, it would have been interesting to see that group. You know, anytime Jesus got together with these people, and I imagine there was laughter and all sorts of things, but there was also the tears of life and all this. In the midst of it, here is Jesus showing mercy to them. But it just ticked off the Pharisees. These guys, enough to where they nail him on it. And that's in Mark 9. They say, How in the world can you claim to be who you are and look at the people that you mess with? The rabble of life. And these are the people that you hang with. And Jesus' response is this. He says, go and learn what this statement means. And he quotes from the Old Testament. Go and learn what this statement means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. I desire mercy. The account goes on here. verse 13 says, but the tax collector, standing at some distance away. In other words, you can picture this guy. He doesn't feel he can even get into this group of believers up here, whether they be Pharisees or not. But instead stands at a distance. I am not worthy to even be in that presence there. Standing at some distance. Was unwilling to even lift his eyes to heaven. You can see this person, kind of down here with his head in his hands, and not like the Pharisee, this kind of thing, but rather humbled and bent over. And not only that, it says, unwilling to lift his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast. That was what you did when you were in mourning. That was what you did when life was so overwhelming to you that you just, that's it. And saying, God, be merciful to me, sinner. In fact, the terminology, the way it's phrased right there, the sinner, is a way that in the Greek language there, it's a way of underlining a word when you say it. God, have mercy on me, sinner. Oh, grieving over who he is and what he has done, seeing himself as he actually is. God, have mercy. I have a friend, I don't know, I shouldn't call her a friend. I have an acquaintance that I interact with every once in a while that's up in Portland. It's a gal up there that I put her kind of in a bit of a hero status. If you saw her, she looks like she's from Santa Cruz. Okay, dreads, and, things poked here and there, and, a few tattoos, and depending where you're coming from, that's either cool or weird, but that's her, and she has this, this ministry, she and her husband, but she's the key person, has a ministry to street people in Portland. And you might say a very successful ministry to street people in Portland. All the street people know her. And she knows pretty much all of them on a first-name basis. Most of her ministry happens at night, walking the streets out there with people who have nowhere else to go. And showing mercy. I've talked with her a couple of times about how she keeps focused. How do you do this? And she each time refers to her own story. And her story has a lot of mess in its background. A lot of mess. That's not mine either. A lot of mess. And one of her prayers each day is, Lord, never let me forget what the bottom looked like. Never let me forget that I am just like these people. Lord, have mercy on me, the sinner. That's how she starts every day. It's part of her rhythm of how she goes through the day. See, the key to becoming a merciful person, ready for this? If you're looking for the key, what's the magic key for doing this? The key to becoming a merciful person is becoming a broken person. The key to becoming a merciful person is becoming a broken person. Now, it doesn't mean you have to invent anything. It just means you come to reality. It's a matter of looking at ourselves and seeing that we're not no different from anybody else. We're broken, fallen people. We are sinners. We are blind. We are numb to the world around us. Our world swirls with all sorts of other mess in our life. We are in need of Jesus. Lord, have mercy on me. Notice how this account ends here. Jesus says, I tell you, verse 14, I tell you, this man, in other words, the tax gatherer, this man went to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. There it is. Now, justified, that's a big Bible word. Basically, which one of these two people went away right with God? Which one of these two people ordered things to where accounts were clean when they walked away with God? And Jesus says, it wasn't the Pharisee. It was the tax gatherer who pleaded for mercy. That's the guy. The starting point for becoming a merciful person is becoming a broken person. And part of that is some way of acknowledging it. That's why this prayer has become such a powerful thing throughout the history of the church. It acknowledges something. That I am a broken person, I am a sinner, I'm fallen, I am in need of mercy every moment of my life. God, please have mercy on me. And as we experience mercy, it gives us something then to play back out again. That as we receive mercy, it lays the foundation for us to be merciful people. In fact, you see a bit of that play out in, not a bit, you see it play out in 2 Corinthians, very beginning of 2 Corinthians, it's chapter 1 and starting in verse 3. It says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies." See that? The Father of mercies. The God of all comfort. And here's this idea of playing it out in some way. Here's how it plays out. The mercies. Who comforts us in all our afflictions so that we will be able to comfort those who are in any afflictions with the comfort with which we ourselves have been comforted. In other words, here's the deal. As I receive mercy, as I begin by pleading for it, and God shows mercy in my life, I turn it around and I play it out, because that's exactly what God has called us to do, to be merciful people who reflect, who actually play back out the very mercy that we have received, and it's evidence of our redemption. You see, being merciful is a symptom. It's evidence that we ourselves have been shown mercy. And as we do that, as we play mercy out, we become more familiar with our own mercy. We become more aware of what God has done in our life with mercy. There's a... I heard this interview. This is about a week ago. I say I heard it. It makes it sound like I was actually listening to it. It's one of those things where I'm in front of the TV going click, 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 and trying to find something where I can land. I was looking for something mindless. You know, and there's a lot of that, but I want mindless that is not terribly corrupt. You know, so I'm going through this thing, and I happen to catch this little clip of an interview with a billionaire, and it was somebody that I didn't recognize. It wasn't one of the common ones. It's one of those that kind of fly under the radar, millionaire guy. And the interviewer asked him this question. He said, "When did you first realize that you were rich?" That a good question? Because that's a sliding scale, isn't it? I mean, if you have nothing and you get a little bit, you think you're rich. And you kind of keep moving that target along there. And this guy, he asked him, "When did you first realize you're rich?" Ready for this answer? This is great. I can't tell you who it said it. But I've been thinking about it for the past week. He said, "I first realized I was rich when I began to give it away." Isn't that a good answer? When he was no longer feeling, "I have to have more, I have to have more, I don't have enough yet." But when he had so much, then he started giving it away. And then I realized I was rich. In fact, the interviewer said, "Say that again." And he did. And that's when we realize we're rich. In the mercy of God, we begin to give it away. We begin to take this and we play it back out. Psalm 18 says, "To the merciful, God shows himself merciful." In other words, we become aware of the merciful God as we begin to play it back out. In Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." Mercy begets mercy. Mercy begets mercy. As we receive it and we play it out, mercy begets mercy, and it grows and it develops. God desires for us, longs for us to be merciful people who have experienced His mercy and play it out lavishly to others. This past week, uh, I had my lab play out. Remember my lab? My lab is my brother. So you're getting weekly updates to make sure that I do what I say I'm doing. Okay? Which I think it was always good to have. Some place where it pushes your boundaries. Some place where you are taking something God says and say, I will live it out here. For me, what kicked it off was David looking for a place, where can I show mercy? And I started, where can I show mercy? And I looked around and I was hoping for something way out there somewhere. The problem was it was right here. My brother. Now, with my study for this week, as I was kind of anticipating where this was all going and looking into God's Word, one of the things I began doing, not as a magic deal, not as a mantra, but as a daily orientation, was to pray, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus, have mercy on me, the sinner, the one who is blind, numb to the world, who has wreckage all around him. Jesus, have mercy on me. Not just once in the morning so I checked it off, but to have that be something that I found myself working into my day. Because it doesn't take anything, right? I mean, you don't have to stop what you're doing to do that. And I found it changing how I was seeing the world around me. I was doing it in anticipation that I was going to see my brother. It wasn't until yesterday that I saw my brother, but this time it was by design. Last time it was because I stalled. This time it was intentional, because you see, there's this farmer's market that takes place on Saturday morning, and it's like a half a mile, maybe a quarter of a mile from where my brother lives. And so my thought was, I'll go to the farmer's market and I will get all sorts of stuff that I know he will never get. I mean, like healthy stuff. And so I had a great time. I went through the farmer's market and I was just, the whole, what would my brother like? What would in some way lift some of the weight of his life? Something I can bring and say, hey, here it is. Do what you want. I don't want thanks for it. Nothing. It's just yours. I didn't say that part, but I mean, it was my thinking. And so I went through and I filled up a whole bag with all sorts of stuff. Now, he doesn't, you know, his teeth are all rotten out too, so it had to be soft, you know. and I had to think, okay, you know, how much of this is going to just throw out? So I tried and get stuff, and I brought this bag in and sat down with him yesterday and laughed and talked about life. Smoke-filled room. What made this a powerful thing for me was that I had been pretty pharisaical with my brother. I'm glad I'm not like him. Now, it is true. I'm glad I'm not in those life circumstances. I'm glad I don't have the same demons he has. But I'm just like him. Lord, have mercy. My encouragement is that you go through the week with this prayer haunting you and chasing you. It weaves into every situation of your life. Lord, have mercy. Let's pray together.